This episode is sponsored in part by Airbnb. You know, Jen and I love trotting around the globe. You gotta trot, you can't gallop or anything. And Airbnbs have become our go-to for a cozy stay wherever we land. So when we finally decided to put down roots and build our own place, we thought, why not sprinkle a bit of that Airbnb magic into our home? We went all out, designed it with a spare bedroom that comes with its own exterior door. This way, our guests can come and go as they please, making check-ins and check-outs a breeze. We've been lucky enough to host folks come into town to visit family and friends. Inspired by our travels, we wanted to make their stay extra special. So we began adding little personal touches here and there, snacks, bottled water, a brochure with our local recommendations that we made, even some cool samples from our show sponsors. It's all about making our guests feel welcomed and cherished. And really, when you think about it, why let your home just sit there gathering dust when it could be your ticket to more incredible adventures? Turning it into an Airbnb not only brings in a little extra cash, but it's also a fantastic way to share a piece of your world with others. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with my producer, Jason DeFilippo. Today's guest has 26 Emmys and a Peabody for Reading Rainbow. He was Kunta Kinte in Roots. He was Geordi LaForge on Star Trek and is a legit cultural icon. Today we're talking to my man, a.k.a. the black Mr. Rogers, LeVar Burton. I wanted to find out why, despite early success, LeVar never had a Hollywood meltdown. He had the right kind of people around him, and we'll learn how we can do the same. This is a tale of almost self-sabotage. Is that a term? Self-sabotage, hustle, resilience, grit. And it's the story of someone who has probably influenced almost every single person listening to the Jordan Harbinger Show. This was such a fun conversation today. I know you're going to love it. And I met LeVar through my network. We're 2 degrees of separation. I'm teaching you how to do all that networking stuff, you know, reach out to people, stay in touch with them, offer value, get them to know, like, and trust you so that you can help each other out throughout the rest of your life. You know, that sort of small, game-changing set of habits that has totally transformed my life and my business. That's a free course, 6-Minute Networking. It's at jordanharbinger.com/course, and I would love to hear what you think about it and how it changes your life as well. In the meantime, here's LeVar Burton.
When people come up and see you, do you ever go, okay, this person probably recognizes me from Star Trek, but that person recognizes me from Reading Rainbow?
I've developed a sort of radar, and I can pretty much peg it.
Yeah. Someone's like, oh, Roots. You're like, yeah, I knew it.
Yep. Star Trek, Reading Rainbow. There's overlap, you know.
Sure.
In the Venn diagram, but basically, it's easy. It's easier these days. I mean, because Reading Rainbow fans are so legion. I mean, it's a generation. I think it's maybe 2 generations.
Has to be.
So they're of a certain age, right? Mm-hmm. So they're kind of easy to spot coming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes they have books in their hands.
Oh, really?
Which is bonus.
So that means you're like, oh, my. When you see that, are you like, oh, yes.
Yes.
Impact.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My mother was an English teacher, so to have... And teaching is sort of it's the family business. My older sister, both nieces, my son. If you're a Burton, you're probably in the education business. And I consider that I am too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, it is cool. I guess teaching is our family business too, but I never thought of it as the family business.
Really?
Grandpa, mom, me, sort of, you know, doing this. Yeah.
Educating. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to.
Right.
Yeah. And having that sort of like larger, I thought about becoming a teacher, and then I heard my parents and other teachers in my family be like, here's all the problems we're having. And they were all so ridiculous. Like, we can't get money for crayons, so I need to take your old crayons and bring them into the, and it just was like, okay, I can't have a job where your own employer is working against you. That's not going to work.
It is a sad reality of the state of education in today's America.
Yeah.
We used to do a pretty good job of educating our kids, giving them what we called a classical education. Not so much anymore.
Not so much anymore.
We're much more interested in spending money on weapons of war and engaging in conflict all around the globe. So, you know, I guess you can't have everything.
No, no. It seems like we could sacrifice something else for education.
It seems, but we haven't made that choice.
Yeah.
Not as far as I can tell.
Not yet.
Definitely haven't made that choice. No, we are full speed ahead on the bombs.
Well, on that cheery note.
Yeah.
Yeah. but you have been in the public eye for as long as I can remember, because I half the time when I was doing the research and reading about you and everything like that, I was like, you have the image of LeVar Burton circa 1987, 88 in your head. Mm. You don't look that much different, but you had a different haircut.
I had a different haircut for certain, and the mustache was bushier, I believe.
That's right, yeah. It was like the 70s stash
that
now makes you either look like a traffic cop, or not a traffic cop, a state trooper, or somebody who's
a porn star.
Yeah, exactly.
The bushy mustache still makes you look like a porn star.
That's true.
But hence a more prim version.
Yeah, yeah. You got to step your mustache game has stepped up. Now you just have to elevate your thermos game,
and then I'm good.
Yeah,
I'm a fully realized human being.
You've been active for a really long period of time, and I want to get into that in a second. But I heard first you almost became a Catholic priest.
True.
Yeah.
True story.
So why did you make the shift to acting? Because it doesn't seem like an adjacent field.
It is, actually.
Really?
It's from my perspective.
Okay.
It is. Why? That's a story. I started really reading about different points of view, other than the Catholic point of view. And I just felt that I entered the seminary when I was 13, so I was pretty young, but I was committed.
Yeah.
And then I had a great teacher. I had a great teacher who was a layman, which is to say he wasn't a priest or a brother. And he taught my favorite subject. He taught English, philosophy. He was also the drama coach, Lee Bartlett. And Lee just introduced me. He gave me books to read. The Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, Kierkegaard. I was reading and expanding my mind, and the Catholic point of view just felt more and more narrow to me. And I just felt I owed it to myself to get out there and live in the world before I made a decision like that. And I was looking around so what am I going to do? I mean, I decided to become a priest when I was around 8 or so.
Wow. Yikes.
I know.
Because I can understand then, like, hey, look, you can never be with a woman. You're like 8. Fine.
Yeah.
And then you're 16 and you're like, what do you mean by never? And how flexible are we with this particular regulation?
So that was a part of it.
Yeah.
That was a part of it, certainly. A large part of it was service, the idea of service. My mom, her second career was as a social worker. So I grew up in a family where it was normal to want to be of service.
Yeah.
That one's life should be about something greater than one's own pursuits, that you should really try and make the world a better place. That's, you know, one of the values that my mother instilled. And so in looking around to find out or figure out what I was going to do with my life, theater arts, it was something that I discovered at St. Pius and really fell in love with it. And I figured, well, I could give that a shot. Plus, now here's where the connections begin, the sort of the overlap between theater and the ministry. The Catholic faith itself is really, the liturgy is very theatrical, right? The vestments, right? The costumes. Mm-hmm. Watch me change this, right? This wine into the blood of Christ.
Yeah, there is a
this
whole lot of
host into the body of Christ. There's some real theatricality in that. I used to have sort of a recurring dream about my first sermon as an ordained priest. And the setting would change. Sometimes it was in a big church. It was a small church sometimes. But the sense that I was reaching people, that I was connecting with them with a message, was very powerful. And I feel like I do that in this job.
Yeah. Well, you certainly do.
It's about connecting, right? And providing something of value to people, something that lifts them up and encourages their spirit, right?
You got a huge role early on with the acting, with Roots. Mm-hmm. That was like a game. I mean, I think you were 19 right then?
I was 19. Yeah. Roots was my first professional audition.
Wow. So that's like hitting a massive home run right out of the gate.
360 feet.
Yeah. Wow. And how did reading... I want to get to why you didn't implode in a second. But I'm curious how reading Rainbow came out of that, because it seems a little bit like an unglamorous role for an actor who just smashed it with Roots. It's like, hey, great job starring in this major motion picture. It's a runaway hit. Now, here's some kids under 10 reading library books, and we're going to do 1,000 takes of them, like, crying and yelling at the camera, and half the show is animation.
I don't think we did nearly that much animation. The connection for me was really clear. Roots really made me aware of the power of the medium of television. I mean, in eight consecutive nights of television, this nation was changed. There was an America before Roots, and there was an America after Roots, and they weren't the same country. Before Roots, it was possible for us to tell ourselves the story that slavery was this necessary economic engine, right? After Roots, we could not even think about slavery. It was impossible to discuss it without holding in mind the cost, the human
the
cost,
human cost, yeah.
Right? That's really powerful, to have a nation that was built on chattel slavery, right? Sort of rearrange its idea around the impact, right? And as I say, the cost. So when the idea for Reading Rainbow was pitched to me to use this very powerful medium for engagement to steer children who are making that decision as to whether or not they're going to be a reader for life, the idea of taking a kid who can read and turning them into a lifelong reader, using the medium of television, mm-hmm. was really attractive to me, right? Because television at that time, we're talking 1984, I think. Yeah.
For Reading Rainbow?
Yeah. And television in the educational community was the evil empire. I mean, it was...
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it was really...
The enemy of education.
It was really counterintuitive, and I loved that about it. And like I said, I had just experienced this massive awareness of just... how much good we could do.
Yeah, it's almost sneaky. It's like, oh, you're going to sit around and watch TV all day? Fine. You're going to spend your summer watching cartoons?
And Reading Rainbow was originally a summer show, right? And that was part of the idea, to go where kids were during the summer vacation and give them something that was fun,
yeah.
Something that was really enjoyable, but it was very stealth education.
Yeah.
Right? It was stealth. And that was attractive to me as well.
It's got to be one of the longest running shows on, was it 21 plus years?
Third behind Sesame Street, of course, and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. And it won a ton of awards, which I went over in the introduction, which I will when I record it, of course. But that makes sense, because 3 months off during the summer is where I essentially forgot every single thing that I learned in school.
We tend to do that.
I remember thinking the first time, probably not my first summer, but one of, I remember thinking, I haven't been back to school in a while. I wonder if my mom just forgot, or if I'm just allowed to watch TV every day forever.
That was your first orientation around summer.
Yeah.
This is great.
It's kind of nice.
When's the other shoe going to drop? When are they going to?
I thought about asking my mom what was going on. Uh-huh. And then I thought, better not. Then she might go, school.
Right?
Oh, you're right. Pack your stuff. You got to go back to school. Yeah, that totally makes sense. I'm wondering if the theme song was stuck in your head for the entire 21-year run of the show, or if you had some breaks.
It's still stuck in my head, Jordan.
Yeah.
It's still there.
It's everywhere. I mean, it's... And not just
in my head.
No.
You know?
No, my wife and my and I are, someone's humming it in the house at any given waking moment.
See?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not a bad little ditty.
No.
It can be annoying as an earworm, but it also provokes fond memories for a lot of people.
A little nostalgia?
A little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can sample it, Jason, for the show. I mean, it might get us sued and run off the air, but we can try a little. A couple seconds. A few seconds.
A few seconds.
Yeah.
Just a few bars.
Yeah. Yeah, they can't get that mad about it.
Come on.
Butterfly in the sky.
I assume you read a lot as a kid. You said your mode of education in the house was primarily reading.
Yeah.
So did your mom just sort of be like, read, you have to do this?
My mom was a reader.
Yeah.
And that was, as it turns out, really critical modeling. And I believe it still is. Parents ask me all the time, how do I get my kid to read more? And I ask them generally two questions. Number one, do they see you reading?
Oh, yeah.
There's that, right?
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, what are your child's passions? if you know what your child is passionate about, then you've got a window into what sort of reading material they're going to be interested in. But the whole idea of seeing my mother read 2-3 books at a time for her own personal enjoyment was, as it turns out, really important information for me to absorb.
It's funny hearing you say that. I didn't really notice until now. My mom's an avid reader. My dad read the newspaper and things like that, but not. I don't think I've ever seen him really read a book. Mm-hmm. But at least somebody was reading in the general vicinity of the children, which mm-hmm. is good. Mm-hmm. And in kindergarten, I was like a bad kid, kind of getting in trouble, hyperactive. I know, big surprise to everyone here listening or watching this. But then I remember my older friend, we had a split class. It was like kindergarten and then first grade in the same room. And my friend Corey had their reading book. And I was like, give me that. And I tore it away from him before class. And I just started reading the whole thing out loud. And the teacher was like, what? This idiot can read better than the kids in the class above. And then she kind of got it in her head that like, oh, okay, maybe he's bored reading one sentence, see spot run, see the dog jump, when it's like, I can just plow through the semester or whatever it was reading.
You were an early reader.
And I didn't even know. And neither did my mom. She had no idea.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. My mom, I think, knew a little bit, but she wasn't sure, or at least I know the teachers didn't know. And of course, every mom is like, my kid's smart. And the teachers are like, no, your kid's an idiot and you're in denial. So, and I was a latchkey kid. My mom was always working. And so there was kind of like a lot of me watching TV or just going and reading stuff in the house and not understanding half of it, probably. But I don't even know if that matters at that point. Sounding out words in kindergarten can do pretty big things, mm-hmm. I think.
Absolutely.
Do you remember when you first learned to read? Because I don't know when I learned to read, but I know when I realized that I could, which was that moment reading Sun Up in kindergarten. I think that was the title.
Two memories. One related to the activity itself. I remember my aunt was visiting from Kansas City, and she was reading with me, and I got stuck on a word. And I thought I knew what the word was, but I was afraid to be wrong. Mm. And so I hesitated and hesitated and hesitated. And then she said it, the word, pretty. And I was like, I knew
yeah.
that was the word. So that was like really important for my own sense of confidence that I actually did know how to read. And then the book that I was reading when I got what reading was all about was third grade, fourth grade, Captain's Courageous. Rudyard Kipling. And when I finished that book, I got really sad and I didn't understand. I was like overwhelmed with sadness. And it was because I had left this world that I had become so connected to and the characters. And to this day, when I'm reading a particularly good piece of short fiction, I slow down the last chapter or so because I know that, you know, that depression.
Yeah.
That inevitable feeling of sadness is gonna be a part of the experience when I'm done. So
yeah, it's like saying goodbye to a friend.
Exactly. And that's the power of literature, right? You make the movie in your head. You invest yourself in the story, literally. And that's powerful.
Yeah. I can see it. Yeah, you don't feel that way about like, oh, I beat Mario Brothers. I'm so sad now.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't have, it's not the same at all. I mean, there's certainly some, you know, positive feeling and benefit from beating a video game, but it's not the same.
Yeah, it's not quite the same. Yeah.
Not at all.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, LeVar Burton. We'll be right back. And thanks for listening and supporting the show. To learn more about our sponsors and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. If you'd like some tips on how to subscribe to the show, just go to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. Subscribing to the show is absolutely free. It just means you get all the latest episodes in your podcast player as they're released, so you don't miss a single thing from the show. And now back to our show with LeVar Burton.
I wondered if there's any books that didn't make the show that got cut for some reason. Like, oh, we recorded a segment on this. Turns out the author is a terrible person. No, so, no?
Didn't happen. We were very, very, very diligent about the literature that we chose. And there was a whole list of requirements that we had for the books in order to be on the show.
Like author is not a white supremacist or something crazy.
I think that was more unofficial than written down as
probably don't need to write that
violet
one.
Law.
Yeah. No. Yeah, that one is a natural. But back before internet though, it's like, oh, we didn't know this person was like fled, you know, Argentina because he was outed as a former, like you don't know that. So now you Google it. Back then it's like, what are you going to do? Background check everyone? No. What do you think about books like Huck Finn, though, being banned in schools?
Huck Finn is banned now?
In some schools, yeah. Because...
The word nigger?
Yeah, is that why? I'm drawing a blank. I think that's the reason.
That would be my guess.
Yeah, yeah. I actually...
That would be my guess.
I knew that was part of it, but I didn't know if there were other things in there that were...
No, not that I can recall. I think it was the nigger thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you agree with that? Or are you kind of like, look, let's not, what, I mean, with your position of roots, it's like, do we need to sort of polish this? This is a thing that was written at that time for that reason.
And we don't, you know, look, this is America.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need reasons for people to develop racist attitudes. And we certainly don't need to encourage it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Let's remove that one from the canon. Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. I can understand that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. I think I didn't even know about that word until a friend told me not to say it, which is sort of defeats the purpose of telling somebody a new word and then telling them not to use it. Mm-hmm. But so is kind of what you're saying then, hey, look, those kids are going to find out this the hard way. They don't need to study it in school.
They don't need to be fed it in school. And it doesn't need to be normalized.
Right.
In any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. I guess they can watch Roots if they want a cold dose of what that was like.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had us watching that in high school. And I remember, you're right. You do go away from that going, oh, yeah, can't really just make this an academic thing anymore. Mm-mm. Can't make this a whole X number of people were kidnapped and imported, and then you go, oh, that was terrible. What's for lunch? It's like you're watching that, and you feel that. You feel it. Mm-hmm. And you see the blood, and you the people going over. I mean, it's traumatizing, and it's like an appropriate dose of that for kids, especially in high school.
In high school, for high school kids, yeah. in an age-appropriate way.
Yeah, I think younger I might have been traumatized. Yeah, it is very... If we lived in like a Fahrenheit 451 culture, mm-hmm. what do you think? You know how some people like memorized books in that movie, mm-hmm. and one woman had a bunch of them, and then mm-hmm. other people just had one. Mm-hmm. What do you think would be your book that you would memorize?
No one's ever asked me that question.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
That's pretty good. That's a good question. Wow.
I'll buy you some time because I thought, oh, he's going to flip this around on me and ask. And the only book I ever had memorized was Where the Sidewalk Ends by Shel Silverstein. You remember that?
I love Shel Silverstein.
I don't still have it memorized, so I'd be useless even in a Fahrenheit 451 culture.
That book is you know, like many of Shel's books, it's a collection of poems that I mean, Shel was a master wordsmith. That's a really good book to memorize in a Fahrenheit.
Yeah, but I'm imagining them being like, we need the old knowledge. And I'm like, well, I do know a poem about kids being stuck in a bathtub and washing each other. Like, anyone else got any books memorized?
So many.
Even if you didn't have to pick like the top one, do you just have one that comes to mind where you're like, ah, oh, that'd be a good one to know?
I definitely want to memorize something by Octavia Butler. She was an amazing writer, and science fiction is my favorite genre of literature. When I'm reading for pleasure, it's generally science fiction or fantasy.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. So you could retell those stories, I guess, in the world of Fahrenheit 451.
Right.
Do you ever feel pressure to be perfect all the time? I mean, you're kind of like Black Mr. Rogers. Is that people tell you that probably?
You're the first.
No. Get out of here. Are you serious?
Yeah. You're the first.
I'm shocked.
I've never been called Black Mr. Rogers.
Or African-American Mr. Rogers?
Right. That either.
Okay, just checking that this wasn't a trick. I'm checking this wasn't a trick. I was telling my wife earlier, I was like, what if LeVar drops like an F-bomb? It would be so amazing because of the character juxtaposition in my head versus you're a real human, obviously.
Right. No, I love swearing.
Yeah,
I do. It's very expressive.
It is.
You know, yeah. Use your words, son. Use your words. Yeah.
I thought for sure people viewed you that way. So I thought, oh, man, whenever
it
you're in
public. It
does
surprise people when I say fuck.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's still, I mean, it's, I'm getting a childish giggle going right now just because of that. But I wonder if you're like out somewhere and if you're ever thinking, I'm in a bad mood, I'm sick of this BS, this isn't going my way. And you're like, there's people watching and they expect me to be the certain way. I better not have a public meltdown or like be annoyed at the airline person or whatever.
There's a saying in French, noblesse oblige. I don't speak French, but loosely translated, if you are noble in any way, then there is a responsibility that comes along with that. And I definitely believe that to be true. My job when I go out in public is to be LeVar Burton, mm-hmm. right? Which means to me that when people recognize me and want to interact, unless I'm eating, then I feel it's part of my job to give them a quality experience, a moment of my time.
Yeah.
That's just how I was raised in the business.
Shaq actually said the same thing. He said, unless I'm eating,
yeah,
I'll be cool about it. He goes, but if you catch me in a meal, I'm going to tell you now.
I'm
going to
tell
you
that this is not the appropriate time for this.
That's fair, though.
I'm eating, right? I'm eating. Yeah.
I'm clearly enjoying this. The food's getting full.
And the first thing out of, and someone who's that unconscious, the first thing out of their mouth is generally, I hate to disturb you.
Right.
Which is a lie.
Right.
You came over here to disturb me while I was eating. that nothing could be further from the truth. You don't hate to disturb me. That's your purpose in being here in this moment. So,
I'm enjoying the shit out of disturbing you, and I want a photo, which is...
Could you just stop what you're doing and pay attention to me?
I don't want a handshake so that you have to go wash your hands again after this and leave your food on the table.
So, that's... but...
That's really funny.
It goes with the territory.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It does.
It seems like probably a small price to pay. And I think a lot of us could do with the dose of, gee, who's watching? Maybe I shouldn't act like an a-hole. You know, I certainly... could use that.
No.
Sometimes.
You?
My wife's like,
Jordan Harbinger, you are the very model of civility and kindness.
So far this morning.
So far.
That's right. Yeah. How do you sort of parse being part of something that is so universal and also so universally good, right? Like reading Rainbow, for example, every kid watched that, whether they liked it or not. It just came on after cartoons, if memory serves, or Sesame Street.
Or they rolled in the AV cart, you know, on Fridays, and you watched it in school.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I think we did watch it in school early on, on a reel-to-reel projector. If you want to feel extra old, I was a kid watching you, but I was watching reel to reel, but you were on the reel. Yeah. Close the windows. Time to watch Reading Rainbow. Teacher has a hangover, which is 100% what that was, 2020 hindsight.
But, you know, it was good for a half an hour.
Yeah.
You know, the teacher could to turn it on and walk away.
Yeah.
Well, leave the room. Knowing that they would come back and the room would be cool. Everybody would be focused on the screen. That's not a bad thing.
No, that's good. Yeah. For once you're playing a movie or a show where it's, you know, they're learning something and not just zoned out.
Exactly.
Yeah. I know that you brought a Kickstarter forward in, was it 2014? Yeah. And you'd set a goal. Was it a million or 2 million?
A million.
It was a million.
A million.
Was that a stretch goal at the time? Cause I'm in just under 48 hours. I think you'd received like, you'd raise 2.7, and I think total was 6.4 million.
6.4.
And I'm wondering if you were like, a million, we'll see if we can get it. Mm-hmm. We'll knock out a couple seasons. And
No. What we were doing was I had gotten the rights to the brand from WNED and raised a little money, little seed capital, hired a team, built an app, the Reading Rainbow app. And we released on the iPad only, right? In 2012. At WWDC, we actually premiered the Reading Rainbow app at the Apple Developers Conference. And then I flew to New York and we introduced it to the rest of the world on the Jimmy Fallon show, which had never happened before. I don't think it's happened since that an app was, you know, got airtime on a nighttime.
No way. No.
Right?
Yeah, there's no,
right?
I mean, it's not even generally, if a new app is like not newsworthy.
Not newsworthy.
In any way.
But, there you have it.
Yeah.
You know, Jimmy, obviously, Reading Rainbow kid.
Yeah. Both
he and his sister, Gloria, So that was cool. And the idea for the Kickstarter was to expand our footprint. We wanted to get it to Android tablets and phones. And the Kickstarter enabled us to do that, and build a website and a specific product designed specifically for teachers to use in the classroom with lesson plans and rostering of 35, 40 kids. I mean, it was it's a very robust, turnkey solution for teachers to use, for supplemental reading, for emerging readers. And then we were able to, again, as a result of the amount of money we raised, we were able to give away 10,000 versions of that
wow
school product to Title I classrooms. That was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
We accomplished everything that we set out to do. It was never about bringing the television show back. I'd already done that.
Yeah. That's right. That makes sense.
I wasn't thinking about, you guys
no
anymore. I was trying to reach a new audience.
It's the same model that you had before.
It's the exact yeah same model. It was a pretty ballsy move, thinking that I could reinvent a television show as an app. But as it turns out, I was right.
It's perfect for an app, man.
The engagement yeah factor, right?
Because you see every kid playing with an iPad at the table. Kids probably don't even care about TV anymore. I don't know.
We were maybe 8 to 10 months into the effort of raising money when the iPad came out, and it was like,
oh wow!
I get now. Now I see where we're going, what we can do, because it was books and videos. It's the perfect delivery system for both of those things, especially given that you could animate the books. You could have a little what they call an affordance. An interaction.
Oh, okay.
Right? An interaction. And what we did with all of the books that we animated was, we would not have something that the child can interact with just for the sake of pushing a button, but, to have it be in concert with the narrative, to help tell the story, right? Yet another layer of engagement. At the end of each book, there was a matching game, right?
Cool.
One of the pieces of art from the book itself, and, you pick the tiles, turn them over, and you match and reveal the whole thing. Yeah, I'm really, really proud of the product.
Yeah,
and we've put the whole things in the hands of Riff, right? Reading is fundamental.
Oh yeah, that's right. I remember those ads or those were they ads? PSAs from back in the day.
Yeah, PSAs.
That's right.
Reading is fundamental. So their mission is to put millions of books a year in the hands of kids, oftentimes giving them their first books, the first books that they've ever owned. So they were looking for a digital strategy as part of their mission. And we got together, and through the generosity of my primary benefactor, an investor, we were able to just put the whole thing in their hands.
It's so slick, though, because it makes sense. There are plenty of people that have smartphones that do not have any books in the house, so you might as well give them a book on a smartphone.
Please.
Because the kids can play
any way we can.
Yeah.
Any way we can.
Wow. I was going to ask if you found it hard with the new Reading Rainbow to compete with things like internet and apps and video games, because I know that you, as we said earlier, you looked at TV, enemy of education, apps or iPad games, enemy of education, but it's like, well, we said that before. And this is how we.
This was our antidote to that.
Yeah.
And the same holds true in the digital realm. I believe in the product's ability to engage children, meet them where they are, and then take them where you want them to go, and certainly enhance their relationship with their imagination. I think that's a critical skill for human beings, to have a connection with their imagination.
What do you think is the biggest enemy of education these days? If it was TV in the 80s, what is it now? Is it internet or?
No, it's the will of the nation.
Yeah.
Or the lack of will to really make this the priority that I believe it should be. It's the same conversation,
Yeah. Yeah, the making it a priority. So
making it a priority. That's the problem.
It's too bad, because if it's like a distraction, you can kind of figure out what's more interesting, and like with going to an app-based thing. But if it's apathy, that's scarier in many ways.
Yeah, and it's more than just apathy. It's a decision that we continually make to spend more money on war than we do on educating our kids. That's a conscious decision that that adults are making every day.
Yeah, that's a little terrifying.
It should be.
Yeah,
because it is.
one of the primary things that we do on this show is we teach complex concepts, critical thinking skills, you know, cognitive bias, logical fallacies, things like that. And through conversations like this or by interviewing somebody who's an expert on a certain topic. And I'll admit, I channel you plenty of times when I'm explaining these concepts because people will write in and go, oh, this is like reading Rainbow for adults, except for the author comes in and talks about the book instead of somebody who read it.
Yay.
And it's maybe not quite as kid-friendly, but that's fine.
But that's okay.
Instead of the Emperor's New Clothes, we have the rise of AI and artificial intelligence in China, whatever.
You're providing a public service.
I do wonder, though, if sometimes there's just... I do sit there sometimes and go, if I talked about things that were more accessible or even just for... I notice shows that are really popular, they'll be like conspiracy theory or comedy. And I'm just going, you know, if I just had a dumber audience, it would be a bigger audience. And then I go, no, this is not what we want. Yeah. We do not want to cater to that denominator.
You are reaching those that need to be reached.
Yeah. Yeah. That want to be reached
that
anyway.
Want to be reached.
Yeah. Back to roots. Why didn't you implode? You were 19. I mean, how come we're not seeing headlines like, LeVar Burton pleads guilt, not guilty, says we have to take his word for it. I mean, how come we don't see?
How long did you work on that joke?
That came to me in the shower this morning. I had to add it to my notes and then re-export my notes because I'm like, I can't not use that.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I didn't implode. I had pretty good foundation, family foundation, good values. Luck, people who cared about me. I had a manager early on, Dolores Robinson, who really looked after me, really, really, really protected me and helped me navigate what at times were very, very confusing and you know, waters. Success at any age is a process one has to adjust to. There's a process to adjusting to it. No matter how old you are or how young, I was 19 and on the cover of Time magazine and known all over the world. It was heady.
Yeah.
Trippy. There were times that I tripped and fell flat on my face, but I always got up. I would not want to have that experience in the current climate of a 24-hour news cycle and everybody being a journalist with a camera on the street. I really feel for these kids these days. I survived. I survived, and I'm glad. When Freddie Prinze killed himself, that was pretty alarming, because people would say to me, "LeVar, you're such a nice kid. Don't change. Remember Freddie Prinze." And I was like, "So what is it about me that you think I'm?"
Oh, it was like reminding you of Freddie Prinze.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, and I was like, it was kind of confusing, but I understood that it came from a good place, a caring place, but it was just a very it felt like a strange message to send. Remember Freddie Prinze.
Yeah. Like, you're doing so well. Don't die.
Don't blow your brains out.
Yeah.
Right?
And you're just thinking like, whoa, man, I'm just trying to have a taco here or whatever. Like, what? I'm fine. I'm on Reading Rainbow. I'm doing root. Like, what do you mean don't? Yeah, that would alarm me too. Because it's kind of like, you don't even see it coming. What does everyone else see coming that I'm not seeing?
What am I not getting?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know? Years of therapy later, years and years of therapy later, I'm still trying to stay out of the headlines.
Oh, you try to stay out of the headlines?
Absolutely.
That's probably a good move.
Yeah.
Because if you optimize for getting in the headlines, then you just start doing crazy stuff.
It's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
I'd rather be known for the work than for my lifestyle.
And you don't feel like, oh man, I'm getting less relevant somehow because I'm not in the news cycle. Maybe it's better just to sort of have that trade-off where you're like, I have privacy.
Well, I feel like I've been relevant for 40 years, no small trick.
Absolutely. And that's not what I meant at all. I just wondered if you felt less relevant not being in the news. Because a lot of people do, whether they're relevant or not.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people aim for the news cycle and they go, oh, that felt good. I need to get more of that. Because when that happens, I get more attention, which translates to cash.
And that's a feedback loop that I just rather avoid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm in my 60s and I try not to think like a teenager anymore and have, you know, those sorts of pursuits.
I think it's good you got therapy. I mean, therapy keeps sane people sane, in my opinion.
It's kept me sane.
Yeah.
It has.
When I was 19, I don't know if I would have been smart enough to listen to my manager and the people around me. Because the natural follow-on question is, oh, how did you get those people around you? But that's not even a relevant question for most 19-year-olds, because the answer isn't, gee, I'm 19 and I'm famous. How do I get a bunch of responsible people to tell me not to do all this fun stuff? It's how do you even think that you should listen to those people in the first place? And that's probably a function of parenting.
I think so. I grew up with a woman who was a real disciplinarian and had expectations of me.
Yeah.
And it was always really important to me to try and please my mom, you know, at least to you know, not get yelled at by her.
To avoid displeasing my mom.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
It's funny.
Exactly. So I guess, you know, some of that carried over. Being a people pleaser, a lot of actors are, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. I guess that makes sense, but I never heard that before. Why is that?
I guess it's just a profession that attracts that personality type. Hmm.
Yeah, I guess most people don't maybe think of that as a stereotypical trait of an actor.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes sense when you say it. I just never thought of it like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot of actors also realize, or they think, look, I'm not a finished product. So they start delving into that to try on different hats or try on different personalities. And then maybe that never gets like cured or satisfied, which is what makes a lot of actors probably really great.
Really good actors.
Yeah.
Actors, right?
Yeah.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, LeVar Burton. We'll be right back after this. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers is what keeps us on the air. And to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget that worksheet for today's episode. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. And if you're listening to us on the Overcast player, please click that little star next to the episode. We really appreciate it. And now for the conclusion of our episode with LeVar Burton.
I heard, though, that you didn't want to audition for parts after Roots for a brief period of time. It was like, I don't have to do this. I'm LeVar Burton, bitch.
That's you know, that part of the learning curve.
Yeah.
Right? Part of the learning curve. And what I didn't realize was how much I was sabotaging myself by walking into a room with that kind of attitude. And when I realized it, it was like, oh, my God, that's not a good look.
Yeah, no.
And in turning it around, I had to remember how much I loved acting.
Mm-hmm.
And I started looking at the audition process as an opportunity to do something that I really, really love. And now it's just get me in the room.
Yeah.
Just get me in the room.
Was there anything that you didn't get or didn't do in your acting career that you think, oh man, I wish I had done that as well?
Yeah.
There's
got to be some.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gigs that I didn't get. And, you know. There you go.
Yeah.
Part of the learning curve.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah. I just wonder if that sort of self-sabotage, or as you called it before, do you remember that teaching you a lesson, or is it just something you got over? Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. It's a huge life lesson. Huge life lesson.
I wonder if
the idea that your shit doesn't stink is such a fallacy.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've all been there. You know, we've all been there. And luckily, I was able to course correct.
Yeah, like you had your success kind of front loaded in that particular era of your life where you had Roots. So, because had you done that 10 years of getting rejected or something like that before that, you might have just given up. But if you have Roots before and then you go through a couple of months or a couple of years where you're either sabotaging it or you're just not getting parts, you're like, well, wait a minute. I know that I can do this because I've done it before.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go, oh, wait, maybe I'm not that easy to work with, or people are getting a vibe that I'm going to be a huge pain in the butt. So I should fix that.
Yeah. That one.
Yeah. Was there a time where maybe your manager said something like, look, Roots, good job. Can't ride that forever. I mean, when did you realize, I'm doing this to myself?
Yeah. It was a process of self-discovery. It really was. And it hit me hard. Right? It really did, because in recognizing that I was in my own way, there was a certain amount of shame in that, right?
Yeah.
I was ashamed of myself when I realized what I was doing, because it's inappropriate, and it's just simply inappropriate.
I suppose it's still empowering, though, to know that it's you doing it to yourself rather than like, oh, I'm just not able to do this.
Well, it's always better to make the discovery and then make the change.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's more rewarding.
How do you recommend other people, or how do you prepare yourself for rejection and the hustle of that you need to make it in show business? Because I would imagine a lot of people go in, you hear these actors that have done 10 years of auditioning and haven't gotten anything. And
you
then
have
they
to have a thick skin.
It's like, I couldn't do that.
You have to have a thick skin. You have to have a sort of a supreme belief in yourself in order to not allow rejection to have that negative impact on you.
It's almost delusional level of confidence.
It is. It absolutely is.
All these 10 years worth of these people, they don't get me. I got this. I would be like, after several months or a year, I'd be like, maybe I'm not cut out for this.
Well, it all depends on why you're in it to begin with.
That's true.
These days, I mean, a lot of the kids coming up these days, they want to be famous. They don't want to be actors. They want to be famous. And there's a big difference.
Yeah, you kind of need that passion.
Bingo.
Yeah, that's the antidote maybe to that self-doubt.
Jordan Harbinger.
It's almost like I'm learning when you're talking. It's amazing. What about people that say, I don't feel any passion for any specific thing? You ever hear that? There's a lot of people that
there are a lot of people that haven't discovered what their passion is.
Yeah.
Or have surrendered their passion and forgotten what it was. I feel for those folks.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, I don't know how to I don't know how to solve that. That's why I threw that monkey back there real quick.
That's a real toughie. If somebody is in that place where they feel no passion for anything.
I just tell them to get as much varied and diverse experience as possible, because this isn't something where I was like, I want to start an internet radio show. That'll be fun, where I talk to people. It was like, this is completely an evolutionary process where I was like, I'm talking about how pathetic my dating life is. We should record these conversations. There's no way to distribute conversations. Podcasting is new. It's a great way to distribute conversations. Dating podcast, ... interviewing people about dating, ... I'm sick as hell of dating. Let's interview other people. And here we are. But that's a 12-year process. Nobody goes, I want to start a podcast and have long. I mean, some people are way ahead of me on that, but I would never have thought about that.
But you discovered podcasting as it was on the ascent.
Sure. Early in the game.
You're an early adopter.
Yeah. Yeah. Like your iPad app, I suppose. Yeah.
And my podcast, you know?
Yeah, LeVar Burton Reads. Mm-hmm. We'll link to that in the show notes, of course.
Would you?
Yeah, of course.
That's cool. Thank you. Appreciate
of course.
It.
And it's exactly, great title.
We try and keep it simple.
Very descriptive of what happens in that podcast, which is LeVar Burton Reads to us and reads.
I say at the beginning of every episode, the only thing these stories have in common is that I love them. And I hope you will too.
Yeah, it's a great tagline. And if you missed Reading Rainbow, or if you miss Reading Rainbow, you can always just listen to LeVar Burton Reads, and instead of somebody reading a story about dragons.
I love that the audience of children that used to get book recommendations from me are now all grown up.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm introducing them to new stories, and in many cases, authors that they've never heard of before. I think it's cool. It's great.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. I didn't really think about that, but you're right. It's like,
do you do any prep at all?
Me?
No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, none. I had never thought about that. That's a good observation. Like, hey, you thought you escaped the gravity of Reading Rainbow.
Not so fast.
Guess what? Mm-hmm. I'm still reading to you.
Still reading to you.
I just don't call it Reading Rainbow.
Right? Right. Because I can't contractually.
Well, because I'll get sued if I do.
Sued. Exactly.
That's funny.
Just that.
Yeah. Pesky law, pesky intellectual property rights. That's funny. Did you try to do something like Reading Rainbow for adults? And they were like, not so fast.
No, but they got very, very upset when it was being referred to that. I never called it Reading Rainbow for adults, but in launching the podcast a couple of years ago and doing press, it was something that was kind of an obvious thing. And people would remark on that, and the folks at WNED got very upset.
Yikes.
And they even tried to enjoin me from using the phrase, but you don't have to take my word for it.
Really? Oh, that's so inseparable from you,
though. I got sued.
I did read about that.
I got sued.
And I assume that at some point your argument was, look, this is something I came up with for that show, but it's so inseparable from me as a human that, like, come on.
The lawsuit was withdrawn.
Mm.
Actually, what happened was WNED just got blown up with negative comments their website, to the point where they had to scrub it all. I mean, they took a pounding.
Well, good, because it's kind of like, what are you going to do? We're not going to use it, but we don't want him to use it, even though he's been using it for 40 years.
It got ugly. But then, yeah. You know, then it was, again, part of a really important lesson for me. That lesson being never try and create a business with somebody else's IP.
Yeah. I have personal experience with that.
Do
for sure.
You?
Yeah, yeah. I separated from an old company. I was doing a show for 11 years, and then my business partners were like, we want to focus on picking up chicks, and I was like, we're 40. This is just kind of sad at this point, and we have a bigger audience of not just, like, lonely dudes that we want to service and really speak to them, and these are our more popular episodes. And they were like, cool, you're fired. So we started over fresh about a year and a half ago. This show's bigger than that last one ever was. Just saying. Not that I'm competitive with it or anything. Just going to sit
my tea. But it's got to be a good feeling, right?
Of course it is. It shows that we're, you know, able to do it. First of all, it shows you're able to rise from the ashes.
And that's right.
And
that
also,
you have resilience
in
your bones.
It's funny that you should mention that, because that was one of the topics that I thought about as well, which is, especially with respect to the acting stuff, that's funny you should mention resilience. Cause,
resilience is a really, it's a beautiful human trait.
Yeah. It's something that a lot of people think is inborn and turns out is built pretty through
experience,
eating some serious dirt.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. And we've all eaten dirt.
Oh, yeah.
But we all don't have resilience.
That's
right?
True. So there's some other catalyst.
There has to be some other factors involved, right? And I've never studied it, but I would imagine that there's more to it than just encountering adversity. You really have to have, it goes back to passion, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I think you're right. There's an ingredient there that we're not seeing, because the negative event is the catalyst, right?
Right, that's right.
It's what says, it's like the fire that burns you away, and then what's left over is either something that's made out of steel, or oops, that guy was made out of wood. He's gone now.
I use that image all the time. The beginning part of my life and career, and the whole Roots experience, where fame and celebrity is concerned, was like walking through fire, and I came out of the fire a tempered piece of steel. I didn't implode. I didn't self-destruct. I learned how to cope. I learned that it doesn't work to try and satisfy every impulse that I have.
This is a 19-year-old guy.
That
no.
it's a non-sustainable strategy for living.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Literally for living.
And I'm happy for that. I wouldn't change a thing given the opportunity.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, you've said in past interviews, or at least online, that you couldn't have even imagined how rich and fulfilling your life would be now, which is, that's gotta feel pretty awesome.
It does.
Like, I had all these wild dreams and then I exceeded them. No big deal.
If I had been given the right to blueprint my life, I wouldn't have been this generous to myself.
That's gotta feel amazing. But also, how do you stop from wanting even more than that? Like, I still have
goals. I mean, sure. I feel like I'm in the last third of my life, and I want it to be the most productive period of my life. I certainly feel like everything that I've learned up until this point, I can pass on.
Sure.
Right? And I want to. I just have other things that I want to do. I mean, I want to have this would be my fourth career, I think, as a writer. I'm just a storyteller. And that's what I've discovered about myself. I'm a storyteller. I was born to storytell, and I want to do it in as many ways as I can. Acting, writing, producing, directing, podcasting. I'm fulfilling my purpose. I genuinely believe that, Jordan. I believe that we are all here for a reason. I believe that it's really important for us to discover and discern what that reason is, right? And then pursue it with everything we've got. And that's what I've tried to do for the last 40 years.
Discovering that reason kind of goes back to our passion discussion.
Absolutely.
So if I say, how do we discover that? It's like, well, now we've come full circle to...
Yeah. Follow your bliss, right? What are your passions? Mm-hmm. What are you passionate about? That is an indicator as to how you should be spending your time.
Can be scary if you think you can't make a living doing something that you're passionate about.
Yeah.
That can be scary.
Right.
In which case, I think maybe you can make a living doing something. It doesn't have to be something that you're passionate about. You can do that in addition to that.
You can.
Yeah. If you can find meaning in something else.
If you are not making a living with something you're passionate by doing something you're passionate about, you can find or exercise that passion in areas outside of your job.
Yeah.
Right? But you have to have some passion for something. You have to.
Yeah. It's what gets me up in the morning, and even when things are bad, you just get back on the horse.
Because it's bigger than you are.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's bigger than you are. And it just makes sense to surrender yourself to something that is larger than you.
I know that you're really selective, or you seem to be very selective in the roles that you take. I mean, mm-hmm. Kwame on Captain Planet, Geordi LaForge.
Our powers combined.
Yeah. For example.
Yeah.
And I know you've also made some cameos as yourself on shows like Community, Big Bang Theory. Mm-hmm. Actually, it must be pretty awesome to be asked to play yourself.
It is.
That's got to be where it's like, oh, we just want you to come in as you.
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, rehearsal handled.
It is flattering. And I love it, you know? You go through, if you're lucky, you know, you go through these phases, these cycles, right? You get famous, and then they say, well, get me somebody like him, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, and if you hang in there long enough, they ask for you.
Sure.
Yeah. Again, you know, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, it is cool. Is there a personal charter you have for things like, okay, this role, all right, it's Captain Planet, so it's good environmentalist stuff. It's going to teach kids consciousness. I'll take that. And then this other role, it's just kind of a hacky comedy. I'm not really into that. I mean, like, how do you Mm-mm. parse those decisions?
No, I don't. No, I'm not one of those guys who can, you know, do what they want, you know?
What do you mean?
You know, guys like Kevin Costner, you know?
Sure.
There are a lot of actors, you know, that can call their shots. They can, oh, I want to do that, right? And then they just go and do that. But you know, I'm a journeyman. I audition.
You still audition for? I guess
absolutely.
That shouldn't surprise me, but
no.
I guess it does.
No, like I said earlier, get me in the room.
Yeah,
just get me in the room, right? I feel like I've done a really good job of taking that which has come my way and killing it.
Yeah. Well, I agree with that.
Right?
Yeah.
I didn't plan this, the trajectory of my career. I didn't. So I definitely believe that there's a force at work here that is much greater than myself.
That's got to be such an awesome feeling to be like, oh, well, I'm guided by the cosmos
or whatever.
Look
at my life, Jordan. Yeah. Look at my life. I mean, I've really considered that I've been kissed by God.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. I mean, that's an amazing feeling.
And I have no doubt that my career represents a force for good. No doubt.
Well, I think we're all on the same page there. Like, I don't think anybody can be like, oh, that Reading Rainbow guy? Toxic. Toxic.
My whole career has been about making my mom proud. I was a latchkey kid, yeah. And I could have been one of those statistics, right? Single mom, worked 9 to 5, you know, the black male child.
The statistics are not in your favor on this one.
They weren't.
No.
And the amount of love, dedication, support and expectation that my mother had for me kept me. It was my guiding compass. It was, you know, my North Star.
That's probably what kept you from, in part,
imploding.
From imploding. Yeah. Because you're like, well, my mom is going to kill me
no
if this happens.
No shit.
Yeah.
Irma Jean did not play. Seriously.
I bet. Yeah. Yeah.
Nah.
Oh, man.
I was afraid of that woman until the day she died. I am not kidding.
I believe you. And so she did her job. Like, yeah, my famous A-lister son. No, he's going to come home for dinner when I say... He's going to be there on time. He will show up to that. I know he's not doing drugs in Hollywood with all those girls.
You know, they are about to rename a park in my hometown, in my old neighborhood.
Oh, that's awesome.
They're going to put my name on it. And my mom's not here to witness that, but she would have been really, really tickled. My mom did everything she could to keep us one foot out of the ghetto, you know? And that's why I love that moment the way I do, you know? She was pretty incredible.
The park is great. I mean, you can't hate it on a park. You can put one of those library things in there where you take a book and you exchange
the little free library.
Yeah.
Maybe we will.
Yeah.
It's my park.
That's right. You can do whatever you want. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That would be on brand.
Yes.
This is random, but in Star Trek, which I remember only a little bit from, you have this visor that allows you to see even though your character is blind. But what is that thing made out of in real life? I mean, are you walking around and you can see through it? Because it doesn't look transparent.
It's not. I couldn't see very much. About 80% of my vision was taken away.
When 80%?
Yeah.
And how are you not just like walking straight into things?
In the first season, the visor was plastic. And then in the second season, we refashioned it out of metal, machined metal. But it didn't allow me, you know, any kind of, I couldn't see above my head. I couldn't see my feet, which was really difficult because my concept of Geordi as the chief engineer was that he moved with alacrity, with confidence and surety all the time. And I couldn't be searching for, you know, so I had to learn how to navigate using things in the room.
Sure.
Right? As points of reference.
Oh my God. As if acting on a set like that is not hard enough. You've got to like not trip on on people.
First rule of acting, know your lines. Second rule of acting, don't bump into the furniture.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, because you got to walk confidently. You can't be like and cut. I mean,
no,
you're just tripping over cords.
Not as a chief engineer. So it was a challenge. And then there's the whole idea of covering an actor's eyes, which tend to be their most expressive parts of their bodies.
Oh, yeah.
There was that, and that was tough. But I think ultimately it made a better actor out of me.
I'm sure, yeah. You know? It's I talk about being thrown into the deep end, though.
Yeah.
It's like having to speak a foreign language on set or something.
And literally, technobabble, that's exactly what technobabble is. Mm-hmm. It's a foreign language. Trying to memorize technobabble is... Because it's not conversation.
No.
It's information, right?
And yeah, you can't really ad-lib much because it's like...
We couldn't ad-lib at all.
That thing is the semiconductor protibulator. Like, you can't mess that up. You got to fix it because somebody's going to be like, hey, that's not what they called that in season one. Geordi.
It was very exacting. You know, some actors would come to the show to guest and have a difficult time because the language was very exacting.
Yeah.
Very exacting.
You must have so much stuff you have to memorize. In fact, when you go to something like Comic-Con or a convention, do they give you like 15 pages of, hey, your character was born here and this is what you did and this is where, cause there are people that know all of that stuff about everybody from Star Trek or Game of Thrones and don't they expect you to know that? I mean, you are Geordi LaForge.
Yeah, but I make it really clear. I'm not an engineer. I'm a fan of the show. But I'm not an engineer. And I certainly don't remember the minutia. There are, of the 179 episodes we did, there are maybe 60, 70 I've never seen or have yet to see.
Oh, wow. Do you have any desire to watch them or are you just kind of
That's the thing. I have that to look forward to for the rest of my life.
That's true.
Encountering an episode that I've never seen because it's on all the time.
Yeah.
Somewhere. Right? So it's fun. It's for me to...
You ever watch your character, like go to Germany and you're like, oh, that's me, except speaking German.
I met the German actor who dubbed my voice in Star Trek.
And did you think, this guy doesn't really, or like, this guy nailed it? I think if I met me in a foreign language, I would judge that person positively or negatively.
Yeah.
I would assess.
I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you thought like, okay, they nailed it with my voice.
He did. He did. And for the German audience, that voice is the voice of Geordi LaForge.
Yeah.
It's not mine.
Yeah, they hear you in English and they're like, not real.
Not really guy. That's not the guy.
That's funny.
Where'd you get this guy?
That's really funny. What are you reading these days?
A lot of short stories for the pod.
Sure.
Almost exclusively preparing for the pods, choosing stories for the podcast. Yeah, it's kind of dominated my literature landscape, the short story. But but I love short stories. I always have. Even as a kid, I heavily into like Ring Lardner and O. Henry. I just think short stories are, it's such a difficult discipline to create a beginning, middle, end, compelling characters, oftentimes with a twist that you didn't see coming in 35 pages.
Yeah.
That's
a good point. It's harder than doing it in 200.
It's so much harder. So much harder. So I really do love the short story form. And so That's what I'm reading.
Yeah, nice.
A lot of anthologies.
Perfect.
Yeah.
This has been amazing. Thank you so much.
Jordan.
Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, brother. My pleasure.
Jason, LeVar Burton, epic win. I mean, I was pretty damn excited about that, and he did not disappoint. I love the story. And reading, it's funny, looking back, reading Rainbow influenced me more than I probably realize. Because I feel like I channel LeVar Burton when I'm trying to explain certain concepts. And we do have, in a way, a similar gig, right? Like a media educator.
Absolutely. I mean, I was not in the Reading Rainbow crowd, but I was in the Star Trek The Next Generation crowd. That's for sure. So I grew up with Geordi. That was he was kind of like my go-to Star Trek guy. And I eventually got to work on Star Trek and got to meet him at one of the movie premieres that I worked on very briefly. But this time getting to hang out and just when he walked in the door, he just oozed cool and was super sweet to all of us. And, you know, I got a hug from LeVar Burton before we left. And I was just like, man, that made my year. He's so smart and just so prescient. And especially with his new podcast where he picks the stories. So it's like his thing. I've listened to that podcast just incessantly and his stories that he picks are great. So he's got such a great ear for, you know, what's out there. And man, he's still kicking ass.
Yeah. Yeah. He's very much on top of the game. And so I'm excited to see what he continues to do. I think it's great that he's still so passionate about Reading Rainbow. To not lose your passion about something for 40 plus years. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that means you're in the right gig, that's for sure.
That's for sure. Yeah, absolutely. If you want to know how we manage to book all these great guests, manage relationships with them, it's all about systems and tiny habits. Check out 6-Minute Networking. That's at jordanharbinger.com/course. Don't do it later. You know you're not going to do it later. You're just saying, you're telling yourself that. But once you need these relationships, you're too late. You got to dig the well before you get thirsty. The drills take just a few minutes per day. Doesn't matter how busy you are. You have 6 minutes. You spent more time on Instagram than you would have doing these drills. This is the stuff that changed the game for us 10 years ago. I wish I knew it 20 years ago. That's all free, and it's at jordanharbinger.com/course. Speaking of building relationships, tell me your number one takeaway here from LeVar Burton. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. There's a video of this interview on our YouTube channel at jordanharbinger.com/YouTube if you want to see us horsing around with LeVar Burton. And of course, there are YouTube-only extras in there that you don't get here on the audio feed of the show. This show is produced in association with Podcast One, and this episode was co-produced by Jason Beam Me Up DeFilippo and Jen Harbinger. Show notes and worksheets by Robert Fogarty. I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. Remember, we rise by lifting others, and the fee for the show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful, which should be in every episode. So please share the show with those you love and even those you don't. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen, and we'll see you next time.